obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
My name is Tony and I'm an alcoholic. And five wars at this table. Five generations of warriors who've had war seared into our souls. But you know what? Those wars were nothing compared to the wars we fought to get here in this room. Tell you a little bit about me. I'm 72 years old. I was born December 8th, 1940. My father blamed World War II on me. He said as soon as the Germans and the Japanese found out about it, they bombed Pearl Harbor a year later. On the day I was born, Dwight Eisenhower told my father, George Marshall can be his God's father, but I am telling you he's going to West Point. And that was an issue in my family because George Marshall was a graduate of the MI. And he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and Ike became Allied commander. My father was with Dwight Eisenhower's adjutant. So I grew up in a military household. You know, I hear how some people talk about in these meetings, they grew up in dysfunctional families. My father was a general. He didn't allow dysfunction. You know, I went to West Point. I graduated from Point in 1961. Upon graduation, I was attached to the 82nd Airborne. While I was at Fort Bragg, President Kennedy came down to review the troops, and I was told that I was now in 5th Group Special Forces because they needed officers. So I wound up in 5th Group Special Forces. On April 19th, 1962, I went to Vietnam as an advisor. On May 27th, 1963, I was captured at a village called Linh Nab, 30 clicks south of the China border in Dong Nha province, North Vietnam. Poisoning water wells on Ho Chi Minh Trail. My capture was a bit of a problem for our government. And I was tried by the North Vietnamese as a war criminal and sentenced to 979 years in Tan Tan Tsun, which means imprisoned in your own mind. I was led through the streets of Hanoi on a rope and people threw feces and rocks at me and everything. I was loaded up into a truck. I was carted 76 clicks north of Hanoi, and I was put in a 46 by 66 by 40 bamboo cage, submerged in 3 feet of water, and left that way for the next 5 years, 7 months, and 14 days. I don't remember one day of that captivity. Somewhere along the lines during it, the weight of my own body broke my bones. I was catatonic when I was released in 1969, when they finally decided to sit down at a table to talk about peace. After arguing over the shape of the table for 18 months, they decided on a round one so nobody could sit at the head of it. Seems to me King Arthur had that idea 400 years before that. Pay attention to history, morons. I could have gotten out 18 months earlier. But they brought me home along with 26 other people. We are still classified, although we've been, elements of us have been declassified. We're now listed. If anybody wants to go look us up, you can find out who we are, but you still can't find out what we were doing there. I was catatonic when they brought me home. I don't remember coming home. The first thing I remember is my being captured. When I was captured with two CIA agents. And they stood the three of us up. And a Chinese colonel who'd been educated in San Francisco had me in the middle, CIA agent on my left, a CIA agent on my right, walked up to me, looked me straight in the eye. He pulled a pistol out of his holster, and he went bang, bang, and then pointed it at me and said, "What are you doing in Vietnam?" And I, West Point graduate, I looked him straight in the eye and gave him my name, my rank, and my serial number. He reached over and took an AK-47 from one of the soldiers, looked at me, and then slammed it down on the instep of my right foot, crushed my right foot. And then he handed the weapon back to the soldier. And then he stood on my foot, and he said, "I'm going to ask you one more time, what are you doing in Vietnam?" And the pain was so excruciating that I told him. And that memory made me a coward in my own eyes. So I'm in a hospital. I'm a Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington. Army psychiatrist sitting in front of me, and he said, "How are we doing today, Tony?" And I said, "Tony, I'm Tony." And as I remembered who I was, I also remembered what I thought I was. And I was ashamed. My father came in. I'd never seen my father cry before. And he said, "You know who you are?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm so glad you're home." And I thought, "Dad, if you knew that I was a coward, you wouldn't want me home." That's what I thought. And I couldn't tell him. Subsequently, I was deemed not physically fit to remain in the Army, mentally or physically. I weighed 89 pounds when they brought me home. I stand here before you slightly overweight, 212. Sobriety's been good. I've beaten well. They let me out. And now a strange thing happened, okay? I had always been in the military. Now I'm a civilian. And see, when I left this country in 1962, all the boys wanted to be Johnny Unitas and all of the girls wanted to be Betty Crocker. I'm getting out of the hospital. It's 1970 and all the girls dressed like Johnny Unitas and the boys all look like Betty Crocker. What the fuck had happened? And I didn't fit. I didn't feel like I belonged. I didn't want to be around my father's people because I was ashamed of who I was. I was a coward. So I ran into a couple of buddies and they said, "Hey, try this, it'll make you feel better." Now understand, I was 30 years old and I had never had a drink in my life. I did not drink one time at West Point. I know some of you may find that hard to believe. But my father didn't believe that command officers should drink, and he thought I would always be a command officer. So I was taught not to drink. My father didn't drink. And they said, "Here, try this." I said, "What is it?" He says, "Jack Daniels." I said, "I don't drink." He said, "Try it. It'll make you feel better." I said, "Well, fuck it." Guess what? It made me feel better. God, did it make me feel better. It made me suddenly feel like I was a part of those people at the bar. So I drank. Subsequently, I got introduced to some drugs, and I tried those too, and they made me feel better. And then I decided to do a geographic because I couldn't. My father was looking at me weird. You know how your fathers look at you when you're not quite living up to their standard? And he gave me that look, and I jumped on an airplane and came to Los Angeles in December of 1973. And I left Baltimore. It was 6 degrees. I got off the plane in LAX, and it was 86 degrees. And I went, I live here. And here I was. One day, I'm doing my normal thing, which is sitting at a bar, a place called Jerry's Deli in Century City, or in Studio City. And I saw this woman sitting at the bar, and she was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. Somebody got a Kleenex, please. I've got some allergies. Oh, thank you. I've got allergies today. They're bothering me a little bit today. Thank you. Thank you. And so I, having had a few drinks and feeling like I knew what I was doing, walked up to her and said, hi, my name is Tony Manziotti. Would you marry me? And she went, I don't know. You're not Jewish. And I said, I'm circumcised. And she said, well, that's a plus. And 17 hours later, we got married. Now, that sounds like a recipe for failure, doesn't it? How many people in this room would bet on that marriage? Thank you. I would, because it worked. My wife and I had a son, the apple of my eye. And then 19 months and 5 days later, we had a little girl. The string of my heart, I'm telling you. And I'm suddenly married to a woman who doesn't want me to drink, so I stopped drinking. Brought me to AA, and I stopped drinking. Got a job, was working. I'm in Chicago. I'm here. I jumped ahead a little bit. I'm here in Los Angeles. My son is 2 and a half, and he gets sick. So we take him to the doctor. And they run some tests, and they find out that he has acute lymphocytic leukemia. So the doctor made arrangements, got him into the City of Hope, and my wife and I spent the next 14 months and 4 days watching our child, our son, die of this horrible disease. We got through it because we had a daughter. We got through it because of friends, family. I was devastated. Then I'm in Chicago, and I get a call from my wife, and she says, Stormy, that's our daughter. She's ill. I'm taking her to the doctor because she's throwing up. She won't stop throwing up. So I said, well, when you get her there, let me know what's going on. So she got her to the doctor. They ran some tests. My wife called me and said, they're running some tests. We'll have the results back tomorrow. I said, okay, call me as soon as you know what it is. The next evening at about 7 o'clock, I get a call from my wife, and she goes, Stormy has acute lymphocytic leukemia. And I went and told my boss. I said, I've got to go home. He said, okay. I got on a jet, flew back, arrived at LAX, car picked me up, brought me to my house, the studio in Encino. Walked up the front steps, walked in the front door. I could see the bedroom light was on at the top of the stairs, master bedroom. I went up there. My wife was in bed. Daughter was next to her. I walked over, bent down to kiss her, and she was ice cold. She had killed the baby and had committed suicide. She left me a 17-page suicide note explaining to me how she could not watch another one of her children die of this disease. And I fell apart. While the police were coming and everything else, my next door neighbor said, "You need a drink." And I said, "You're goddamn right I do." And for the next 5 years, I drank through a great job, a house, all of my friends, my family. I got into heroin. When my father died, my brothers came and got me and brought me to Baltimore for my father's funeral. They put me in a hotel and they said, "Get dressed, we'll be by to pick you up in 2 hours to take you to the funeral." I got dressed and there was some time to kill, so I went down to the bar and had a couple of drinks and then went out and found some heroin and did not make it to my father's funeral. And my brothers have not spoken to me since. And just for the record, I'm sober 32 years. And they still haven't spoken to me. You don't always get forgiven. The last day that I drank and used is the day that I hold on to with all the passion I have for this program. On the last day that I drank and used, I was homeless. I was living in the park in North Hollywood. I was living in a cardboard box under a bridge. I had on a pair of pants I'd had on for at least 3 months. I had a t-shirt on. I don't know how long I'd had it on. I don't even know what color it originally was, but it was pretty black. I had 2 shoes that didn't match and no socks. And the only thing I had to my name was a 9mm pistol. And I put it in my mouth and I was going to end it all. But somebody saw me with the weapon, they called the police and cops showed up in force. They all had guns pointed at me and they kept telling me to drop the weapon. And suicide by cops seemed like a good idea. And then suddenly the cops parted ways and a lieutenant from the North Hollywood Division named Ed Miller walked up and he said, "You want to kill yourself, kid, and you haven't got the guts?" He said, "Take the gun out of your mouth," and pointed at me. He said, "I got 19 cops here. I'll shoot you dead and you'll be gone before it's over. You won't even know what hit you. They're all good shots. Or you can put the gun down and come with me. There's hope." I said, "Right, put the gun down. You're going to take me to jail." He said, "I'm not taking you to jail, I swear to God." I said, "Oh, great, you're going to take me to Metropolitan State Hospital. Been there, done that." He said, "No, I'm not going to take you to the hospital unless you tell me you need to go." He said, "I'm going to take you somewhere where they might be able to help you, where there's hope." And I said, "Okay." And I put down the gun and I got up and assumed the position. And he said, "I'm not handcuffing you. Come with me." And he walked me to his police car and he put me in the front seat of the police car. And I don't know about the rest of you, but I ain't never been in the front seat of a police car. All of my excursions in police cars were in the back seat with my hands tied to my feet, etc. Because I'm mean. And he drove me around the park to Chandler Lodge. And John White was running Chandler Lodge at the time. And John looked at me and he said, "Are those dog tags?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Are they yours?" And I said, "Yeah, they're mine." He said, "We're not in a position to detox you." And he said, "Judging from the tracks on your arms and the way you smell and everything else," he said, "you got more than an alcohol problem." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "If you'll check yourself into the VA hospital," he said, "and go through the detox program there," he said, "when you get out, I'll have a bed here for you, and you'll get a chance." So I said, okay. And he said, Miller, he said, leave him here. We've got some people that'll take him to the hospital. And an hour later, Ed Wade showed up with Dr. Paul Oliger. Dr. Paul. And they said, with Mike Ross and Chuck Chamberlain, you come with us. So I did. And they took me to the Wadsworth VA. And I walked in, and they said, we need to detox him. And he said, you ready to go through this? And I said, yeah. And they made me sign the voluntary thing, okay? And I said, I didn't know that when you signed that, this is like enlisting in a fucking military. I signed that. I couldn't get out. I agreed to stay there until they decided to release me. They didn't tell me that. I thought it was like any other hospital. Fuck you, I'll leave. No. And two of the biggest guys I'd ever seen in my life came and grabbed me and took me and put me in five-point restraints. And for the next 28 days, I stayed in those restraints with IVs in me and everything else. And I threatened everybody's life. I was going to kill everybody. But the one thing that was amazing was every day of those 28 days, Dr. Paul came and talked to me. Sat beside my bed and talked to me. One day he said, if you'll promise not to hurt anybody because you threatened everybody here's life, he said, I'll get him to let you off this bed, take you out of these restraints. And he said, 5 days, you'll be able to get out of here. So I agreed, and they took me out of the restraints. And 5 days later, Dr. Paul, Mike Ross, and Ed Wade picked me up at Wadsworth Hospital to take me back to Chandler Lodge. And on the way there, they picked me up at 11 o'clock, and they said, we're going to the noon Radford meeting. And I said, when we get there, they're going to ask if there's anybody in their first 30 days of sobriety. You're going to stand up and identify yourself. And I said, wait a minute. I got 33 days. And Dr. Paul looked at me and said, they don't fucking count. Do you hear me? They don't count. I said, why? He said, because it wasn't your choice. You see, they kept you from drugs and alcohol. Now you're out here. Now you have to do it for you with our help. You have to make a decision not to pick up the drink right now. And he said, if you can't make that decision, we'll let you out of the car right now. And there's a liquor store, and I'm sure you can find a drug dealer. So I went to the Radford meeting. And on March 2nd, 1981, I stood up and said, my name is Tony, and I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And from that day to this, I have never stopped drinking and I've never stopped using drugs because I can't. I'm a drug addict and an alcoholic. What I've been able to do is not have a drink today, not have a pill today, not have a fix today. And I'm 32 years from my last one. But if you're new in this room, I'm just as close to my next one as you are. All I am is one bad decision away. You know, I hear a lot of people a lot of times say, God got me sober. God didn't get me sober because he didn't get me drunk. Dr. Paul and I used to fight about God because I didn't believe in God. I don't know how many men in this room have been in combat. You kind of lose a little faith in God in combat. You pray to him to keep you alive, but then when you see what happens to your buddies and to other people, there's a part of you that goes, if there is a God, he really doesn't give a shit. And that's where I was. One day I said to Dr. Paul, I said, I don't believe in God. And he said, no, you don't believe in the Santa Claus God. I said, the Santa Claus God? He said, yeah, don't believe in the Santa Claus God. He said, most people don't believe in the Santa Claus God. They claim they do, but they don't. And I said, what the fuck is the Santa Claus God? And he said, you know, the God that gives you things if you're good and takes things away from you if you're bad. He said, that ain't God. That's what your parents tell you to make you be a good little boy in Sunday school and sit there and not make noise during church. He said, the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll introduce you to him, Tony, is a God that provides us with our strength. He rewards us with our strength. He doesn't make me strong enough to defeat my alcoholism, but he makes us strong enough to defeat my alcoholism today. I have a God in my life that I say a prayer to all the time. It is, God, show me the path and give me the strength to walk it, and he always does. I don't ask him for the lottery numbers. I don't ask him for new cars. I don't ask him for jobs. I don't ask him to help me lose weight. I don't ask him for any of that. I just ask him for the strength to deal with what's in front of me. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Dr. Paul and what he taught me, because it's invaluable to me, and it may be valuable to you. It's invaluable to me. He used to say to me, he'd say, you got to know the meanings of certain words, Tony. And you think you know the meaning of them. I said, yeah, I'm a college graduate. I'm intelligent. He said, do you know the meaning of the word freedom? And I said, yeah. Without restriction. Being able to do what I want to do. He said, without any consequences. I said, yes. He said, nope, that's chaos. He said, freedom is not having to spend one moment concerned or frightened or fearful of the consequences of the action you just performed. Never having to look over your shoulder to see who's coming after you. Never having to worry that somebody busted you on a lie. Never having to be concerned that somebody knows you stole from them or you abused them or you used them. He asked me if I knew what the word serenity meant, and I said, yeah, it's tranquility and peace. He said, what does that look like, Tony? I said, well, you know, it'd be like a vacant field with flowers, and you're laying in a tree hammock, and the birds are chirping. He said, that's called a vacation. He said, serenity is the inward knowledge that you have the tools to cope with what's in front of you. And I used to think, when he said that to me, that what he was talking about was me being able to cope with something all by myself. Self-sufficient. My greatest tool in life is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my greatest single tool. Because when things aren't right for me, or I don't think they're right, or I don't like the way they are, I found in this fellowship the people who helped me walk through that. You know, Dr. Paul used to explain to me, and he had this story, and I always loved it. There's a man who has a field, and this field is the most fertile field in the valley. He can grow enough food on this field to feed everyone in the valley and then some. And he does feed everyone in the valley from just one little area of his field, because you see, he has this gigantic boulder in the middle of his field. But he's able to grow enough food to feed everybody in the valley. And then one day the man hears the people on the other side of the hill are starving. And he says to his wife, he says, if I can move the boulder, I could feed them if I could move the boulder. And his wife says, you have to move the boulder. So the man goes out, and with all of his abilities and everything that he can think of and everything that he can try, he tries to move that boulder. And he can't budge it an inch. And he sits down beside of the road, frustrated and depressed and angry at his own shortcomings. And a holy man walks by and says, "Why are you so angry and depressed?" And he said, "Because I cannot move this boulder, and people are starving, and I can feed them if I can move this boulder." And the holy man said, "Have you tried asking God for the strength to move the boulder?" And the man said, "No." And he said, "Well, ask him." So the man gets down on his knees and, "God, give me the strength to move the boulder." And the holy man says, "Now try to move the boulder." So the man goes over and pushes on the boulder like this, and it doesn't move. And he turns to the holy man. He said, "You didn't give me the strength." And the holy man said, "You're not trying to move the boulder. You're trying to get God to move it. Put everything you've got into that boulder, moving that boulder. Put every ounce of effort you've got, every bit of your being into moving that boulder, and God will help you move it." So the man puts everything he's got into it, and he moves the boulder an inch, and now he's furious because he goes, "It only moved an inch. I need more." The holy man said, "No, you don't. Before you couldn't move it that inch. Now you've moved it that inch. Your sense of being, your sense of worth will be how well you put yourself into what you're doing. And God will always be there to add a little bit of extra strength. Most of the time in my life, that extra strength has come from another member of Alcoholics Anonymous who's helped me get through something or deal with something." Sense of self. I was ashamed when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was ashamed of who I was. I was ashamed of what I thought I was. Dr. Paul said, "Our secrets own us until we don't own the secret anymore." Now, I've got two Purple Hearts, a Distinguished Service Cross. And for a hit of heroin, I sucked a dealer's dick.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
That's what I did to support my problem, my disease, my habit. You know what? That ain't me. That ain't me. Not today. That was me then. I don't have any secrets that anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life is an open book. Because I don't want to have to hide anything from the people that saved my life. When I was about 3 years sober, I was battling with myself over the death of my wife and my two children. And I could not stop thinking about it. And it was getting to the point where I was desperate for some kind of relief. I didn't think I was going to drink or use, but I was almost certain I was going to go to the top of the fucking 9,000 building and jump. And I told Dr. Paul, I can't do this anymore. And he said, "Tony, God fixed it." I went, "No." He said, "God fixed it." And he said, "I can prove to you that God fixed it." He said, "I'm so sure I can prove to you that God fixed it, I'll give you 10,000 to one odds for a dollar. But I can prove to you categorically that God fixed it." Now, I'm an intelligent man, and God at that point was a suppositional issue to me, so I looked him straight in the eye and said, "You're on. Go ahead, prove it." He said, "Okay." He said, "But I want to make another bet with you. So I'll give you 10,000 to one odds on this one too. I can do something in 7 seconds you can't do in 3 minutes. Ah, again, the genius of myself wakes up and I go, Can I watch you do it? He said, yes. I said, can I watch you do it more than once? He said, absolutely. I said, you're on. And he goes over to his desk and he takes out a 3-inch long wine cork. And in both ends of the wine cork, he had stuck a fish hook so that the eyes of the fish hook were directly in line with each other. And he took a piece of 6-pound nylon test fishing line and he said, here's all you have to do, Tony. And he pushed the line through the eye of one hook and straight across and through the eye of the other hook. And it took him about 3 seconds. He said, if you can do that in 3 minutes, you've got 10 grand. I said, no problem. And he said, wait a minute. He said, we have another bet about God fixed it. He said, so before you do this, he said, I want you to tell me about the night you found your wife and your daughter. I said, I'm not going there. He said, no, I'm a doctor. I got a couple of medical questions I want to know. Were her lips blue? I mean, was she cold and clammy to the touch? How long had she been dead before you got home? And I am just boiling inside because he's pushing buttons. And I look at him and I said, you know what, fuck you. And he said, here, now do it. And he gives a thing to me. And I said, I'm in no mood to do this. And I threw it down. And he says, you need 10 grand. He said, all you got to do is this. And he did it again. And it looked so simple, like, give me that. So I put the thing, and as the line goes across, it drops down, and it won't stay straight and go across. And I'm trying to figure out how to get that to work. And then one time it catches on the hook, and it bends like this, and because it was nylon, it sprung up and almost went in the hole. So now I've got it figured out. Ah, ha, ha. I got it here, and I'm trying to get it just in that right spot, and it springs up. And Dr. Paul goes, you owe me a dollar. I said, I owe you a dollar? He said, yeah. I said, why? He said, it's been 7 minutes. I said, 7 minutes? He said, oh, you owe me $2. I said, what do you mean I owe you $2? He said, I just proved to you that God fixed it. I said, what? He said, God fixed it. He didn't fix it for you, Tony. He fixed it for everyone in the face of the earth. Because when God created man, he made it impossible for him to think about the past and focus on what the fuck he's doing right now. You know what? Whenever I get upset about my life or something's not going the way I want, the easiest way to deal with it is to get into action doing something else. Helping other alcoholics. Getting involved. That has saved my life a lot of times. Because you see, I have to focus on something. Otherwise, my past wants to tell me that I'm not worthy of standing here doing this. It wants to tell me that because I could not hold my mud in Vietnam, I shouldn't be here. Not true. You know, the greatest thing about this program for me has been that I learned that the strength of God exists in us. When I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I caught on to all the catchphrases, you know, higher power. Dr. Paul told me, he said, I'm going to tell you something right now you're not going to like. And he said, if you read this book talks about a power greater than us, and then it talks about God. Do you think it's talking about the same thing? I said, yeah. He said, oh, so alcoholics are just fucking redundant? I said, yeah. He said, no. He said, the power greater than you is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the source of that power is God. Because he answers my prayers through you. There have been times when I have felt like I wasn't worth anything. And somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous would call and ask me a question that I could answer. Sometimes they'd ask me a question that I would have to think about. Sometimes they would call me and want to talk about something, and we would talk until it was resolved for both of us. That's God. That's the way God's worked in my life. I don't know, for some of you, maybe he is the Christmas tree God. Maybe he gave you your car. or your parking space today? I don't know. But what he gave to me was Alcoholics Anonymous. They say there's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole. Well, I'll tell you right now, I don't believe there's any such thing as an atheist that's a grateful alcoholic. Because if you're a grateful alcoholic, you found God. You may not know how you found him. You may not be able to describe him, but you are aware of him. I hear phrases in Alcoholics Anonymous like, hang on, hang in there with the winners. What the fuck are the losers? The people that go out? No. No. I used to think that I was better than the people who went out because I didn't go out. I thought I worked a better program. I thought I lived a better program. The only difference between me and the person that goes out and comes back is they didn't turn to this fellowship to help them honor that decision to turn their will and their lives over to the care of God as we understood it. I asked Dr. Paul what that meant one time. He said, do you know what the third step is? Made a decision. That means you made up your fucking mind. I went, yeah. He said, to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. Doesn't say to the direction of God, and it doesn't say, it says to his care. He said, now, how would you turn your will over to his care? He said, I'll tell you how. God's demand for you, for me, for every person on the planet is exactly the same. And this I believe with everything inside my being because it made such perfect sense to me. God's demand for his care to protect me and to care for me is that I be honest, respectful, and responsible. And as an alcoholic, I can tell you it is hard to be honest when you're at fault. As an alcoholic, I can guarantee you that it's fucking near impossible to be respectful when you're angry. And as an alcoholic, I can tell you categorically that it is hard to be responsible when it stands in the way of a drink. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to be honest, taught me how to treat my fellow man with respect. I'm humbled by World War II veterans. I'm humbled by every person in this room who's come to hear me. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic that's had his life given back to him by this program. There are people everywhere that think an alcoholic is a person who can't stop drinking. I told Dr. Boy, he asked me if I knew what an alcoholic was. I said, yeah, it's a person who can't stop drinking. He said, well, okay. He said, if an alcoholic can't stop drinking, what's Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, it's the daily reprieve. He said, that's right, it's the daily reprieve. But he said, let me tell you the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic, Tony. He said, it's right there in step one. That step tells you the difference between a normal person and an alcoholic. But most people don't know that. He says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That makes us normal. And that our lives had become unmanageable is what made us alcoholics. You see, a normal person, you give a normal person 10 ounces of alcohol, they're drunk. You give me 10 ounces of alcohol, I'm drunk. The difference between an alcoholic and a normal person is that normal person feels impaired. They don't trust their judgment. I'm improved. I'm ready. Not only am I improved, but how many of you in here know categorically I drive better when I'm drunk? Shit, I not only drive better, I'm willing to give driver's ed to the cops. And did. And that came to my, that came to be proven to me when I was 11 months and 4 days sober. You see, prior to my last hurrah, 2 years prior to my last hurrah, I had been sitting at a place called the Rock Corporation from 10 o'clock in the morning until 2 in the morning when they closed, drinking Jack Daniels and going in the bathroom and shooting heroin and cocaine and coming back out and drinking some more Jack Daniels. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I realized I was too drunk to drive home. My indication of that was, number one, I had to hold on to the building to get to my car. So I made a decision to sit in my car until I got sober. So I sat in my car. After about 20 minutes, I had not passed out, so I thought, okay, the cops have now all cleared the bar routes, so I'm just going to drive out of here, and I'm going to drive 2 blocks down to Hart Street, and I'm going to turn right, and I'm going to drive to my house, which is only 2 blocks away, and I'm not going to go more than 10 miles an hour. When the cops got there, I was crawling across my front lawn, and my car was on my neighbor's porch. And when the cop picked me up, I said, "You can't fucking arrest me. I'm home." And he said, "I beg to differ." And he said, "Do you know what you did?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You hit 17 parked cars coming down this street." Now, here it is, everybody. I turned around and looked, and there were cars all over Hart Street. And I turned back to the cop and I said, "Of course I hit him. Look at the way these assholes parked him." I heard that in the courtroom and everybody did what you did. They laughed. One person in the courtroom didn't laugh was me. I was 11 months sober and I realized that Dr. Paul was right. When I'm drunk, I think I make perfect sense. I think I'm intelligent. I trust my judgment because I do those things when I'm drunk. I don't drink today. I don't want to drink today because I don't want to have to try and explain an action that's unexplainable to another human being or to a friend of mine or to my family, because we've all been there. We've all tried to explain the unexplainable. You know, I know what alcohol and drugs did to me and for me. And I'll tell you what. I've heard people say at meetings, "I wouldn't trade my best day drunk for my worst day sober." Well, I just want to shoot those people in the head because they're probably fucking full of shit and aren't going to be sober a year from now. I will tell you something. I'm going to tell you something. My best day drunk, I got nominated for an Academy Award, went to the Academy Awards, and wound up in Cancun with two 19-year-old starlets, an ounce of cocaine and Dom Perignon champagne and a menage a trois that made Satan jealous. My worst day in sobriety was at Cedars-Sinai Hospital when the doctor came down and told Max and all of us that Dr. Paul wasn't going to make it through the night. And if you don't think I wouldn't trade that moment for that moment in Cancun in a heartbeat I'd change it. What I won't do is I won't trade that moment for that moment when I sat in the park with a gun in my mouth, convinced that not one human being on this planet cared whether I lived or died. didn't want to drink anymore, didn't want to do any more drugs, and couldn't find the courage to pull the trigger. Incomprehensible demoralization. I never want to feel that again. You know, if you're new here and you care about things, I'm going to tell you a little quick little story and I'll end with this. I was about 3.5 years sober, and I'm at Dr. Paul's house in Orange County, and we were doing some fourth step work. And please understand that my fourth step was like towing a 47 Buick uphill with a rope by yourself. because Dr. Paul said, it passes a bullshit test, but it ain't passing the truth test. And it took me a while to get down to the truth. But I'm sitting there and I said to Dr. Paul, I said, I'm so grateful that you're my friend. And he looked me straight in the eye and he said, I'm not your friend, Tony. And I was devastated because the way he said it to me, I am not your friend. And I said, then why are you wasting your time with me? He said, because it is my responsibility to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, that's the only reason? He said, at this point, yes. And he said, I'm going to ask you a question, Tony. Do you want me to be your friend? I said, yeah. And he said, then what's your responsibility to me? I said, my responsibility to you? Well, I do what you want me to do? He said, I didn't say, how do you please me? I said, what's your responsibility to me? I said, I don't know. He said, I'll tell you what it is. Your responsibility is to take these steps and become the kind of person that I, of my own free will and choice, choose to call friend. That's your responsibility. When I was 8 years sober, I took a cake at Radford. Dr. Paul and Max came, and Dr. Paul gave me my 8-year cake. Afterwards, a bunch of us went to Jerry's Deli for coffee. And while we were sitting there at Jerry's Deli for coffee, they brought out a square chocolate cake. And it had 8 candles on it. And they brought it to the table. And the waiters there were singing happy birthday. And I looked down at the cake and it said, happy birthday to our friend Tony, Paul and Max. I had become his friend. I had met the responsibility of becoming the kind of person that Dr. Paul chose to have as a friend. I'm sorry, but that is a profound moment in my life, and I apologize for the tears, but I can't help that, and I'm not ashamed of that. I look around this room and I see people in this room that I know that are friends. I am a blessed man. I am blessed to be a part of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am blessed to be at this podium with these other warriors. I am blessed to stand before you, and I want to thank you for the graciousness you've shown me today in giving me your time. Thank you so much.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.